Yes, I remember it now. That is why the name is familiar. But I really know nothing of the details. Holmes waved his hand towards some papers on a chair. I had no idea that the case was coming my way, or I should have had my extracts ready, said he. The fact is that the problem, though exceedingly sensational, appeared to present no difficulty. The interesting personality of the accused does not obscure the clearness of the evidence. That was the view taken by the coroner's jury, and also in the police court proceedings. It is now referred to the assizes at Winchester. I fear it is a thankless business. I can discover facts, Watson, but I cannot change them. Unless some entirely new and unexpected ones come to light, I do not see what my client can hope for.
Your client?
Ah, I forgot I had not told you. I am getting into your involved habit, Watson, of telling a story backward. You would best read this first. The letter which he handed to me, written in a bold, masterful hand, ran as follows. Hotel Claridge's, October 3rd. Dear Mr. Sherlock Holmes, I can't see the best woman God ever made go to her death without doing all that is possible to save her. I can't explain things, I can't even try to explain them, but I know beyond all doubt that Miss Dunbar is innocent. You know the facts, who doesn't? It has been the gossip of the country, and never a voice raised for her. It is the damned injustice of it all that makes me crazy. That woman has a heart that wouldn't let her kill a fly. Well, I'll come at 11 tomorrow and see if you can get some ray of light in the dark. Maybe I have a clue and don't know it. Anyhow, all I know and all I have and all I am are for your use, if only you can save her. If ever in your life you showed your powers, put them now into this case. Yours faithfully, J. Neil Gibson.
There you have it, said Sherlock Holmes, knocking out the ashes of his after-breakfast pipe and slowly refilling it.
That is the gentleman I await. As to the story, you have hardly time to master all these papers, so I must give it to you in a nutshell, if you are to take an intelligent interest in the proceedings. This man is the greatest financial power in the world, and a man, as I understand, of most violent and formidable character. He married a wife, the victim of this tragedy, of whom I know nothing save that she was past her prime, which was the more unfortunate as a very attractive governess superintended the education of the two young children. These are the three people concerned, and the scene is a grand old manor house, the centre of a historical English state. Then, as to the tragedy, the wife was found in the grounds, nearly half a mile from the house, late at night, clad in her dinner dress, with a shawl over her shoulders, and a revolver bullet through her brain. No weapon was found near her, and there was no local clue as to the murder. No weapon near her, Watson. Mark that. The crime seems to have been committed late in the evening, and the body was found by a gamekeeper about 11 o'clock. When it was examined by the police and by a doctor before being carried up to the house. Is this too condensed, or can you follow it clearly?
Oh, it's all very clear. But why suspect the governess?
Well, in the first place, there is some very direct evidence. A revolver with one discharged chamber and a caliber which corresponded with the bullet was found on the floor of her wardrobe. His eyes fixed. And he repeated in broken words, on the floor of her wardrobe. Then he sank into silence, and I saw that some train of thought had been set moving, which I should be foolish to interrupt. Suddenly, with a start, he emerged into brisk life once more. Yes, Watson, it was found. Pretty damning, eh? So the two juries thought. Then the dead woman had a note upon her, making an appointment at that very place and signed by the governess. How's that? Finally, there is the motive. Senator Gibson is an attractive person. If his wife dies, who more likely to succeed her? and the young lady who had already, by all accounts, received pressing attentions from her employer. Love, fortune, power, all depending upon one middle-aged life. Ugly, Watson, very ugly.
Yes, indeed, Holmes.
Nor could she prove an alibi. On the contrary, she had to admit that she was down near Thor Bridge. That was the scene of the tragedy. About that hour. She couldn't deny it, for some passing villager had seen her there.
That really seems final.
And yet, Watson, and yet, this bridge, a single broad span of stone with balustraded sides, carries the drive over the narrowest part of a long, deep, reed-girt sheet of water, Thor Mere, it is called. In the mouth of the bridge lay the dead woman. Such are the main facts. But here, if I mistake not, is our client, considerably before his time.
Billy had opened the door, but the name which he announced was an unexpected one.
Mr. Marlowe Bates was a stranger to both of us. He was a thin, nervous wisp of a man with frightened eyes and a twitching, hesitating manner, a man whom my own professional eye would judge to be on the brink of an absolute nervous breakdown. "You seem agitated, Mr. Bates," said Holmes. "Pray sit down. I fear I can only give you a short time, for I have an appointment at 11." "I know you have," our visitor gasped, shooting out short sentences like a man who is out of breath. "Mr. Gibson is coming. Mr. Gibson is my employer. I am manager of his estate. Mr. Holmes, he is a villain, an infernal villain."
"Strong language, Mr. Bates."
"I have to be emphatic, Mr. Holmes, for the time is so limited. I would not have him find me here for the world. He is almost due now, but I was so situated that I could not come earlier. His secretary, Mr. Ferguson, only told me this morning of his appointment with you."
"And you are his manager?"
"I have given him notice. In a couple of weeks I shall have shaken off his accursed slavery. A hard man, Mr. Holmes, hard to all about him. Those public charities are a screen to cover his private iniquities. But his wife was his chief victim. He was brutal to her. Yes, sir, brutal. How she came by her death, I do not know, but I am sure that he had made her life a misery to her. She was a creature of the tropics, a Brazilian by birth, as no doubt you know."
"No, it had escaped me."
"Tropical by birth and tropical by nature. A child of the sun and of passion. She had loved him as such women can love. But when her own physical charms had faded, I am told that they once were great, there was nothing to hold him. We all liked her and felt for her, and hated him for the way that he treated her. But he is plausible and cunning. That is all I have to say to you. Don't take him at his face value. There is more behind. Now I'll go. No, no, don't detain me. He is almost due." With a frightened look at the clock, our strange visitor literally ran to the door and disappeared.
"Well, well," said Holmes, after an interval of silence. "Mr. Gibson seems to have a nice, loyal household. But the warning is a useful one. And now we can only wait till the man himself appears."
Sharp at the hour, we heard a heavy step upon the stairs, and the famous millionaire was shown into the room. As I looked upon him, I understood not only the fears and dislike of his manager, but also the execrations which so many business rivals have heaped upon his head. If I were a sculptor and desired to idealize the successful man of affairs, iron of nerve and leathery of conscience, I should choose Mr. Neil Gibson as my model. His tall, gaunt, craggy figure had a suggestion of hunger and rapacity, an Abraham Lincoln keyed to base uses instead of high ones would give some idea of the man. His face might have been chiselled in granite, hard-set, craggy, remorseless, with deep lines upon it, the scars of many a crisis. Cold,
grey eyes, looking shrewdly out from under bristling brows, surveyed us each in turn. He bowed in perfunctory fashion as Holmes mentioned my name, and then, with a masterful air of possession, he drew a chair up to my companion and seated himself with his bony knees almost touching him. "Let me say right here, Mr. Holmes," he began, "that money is nothing to me in this case. You can burn it if it's any use in lighting you to the truth. This woman is innocent, and this woman has to be cleared, and it's up to you to do it. Name your figure."
"My professional charges are upon a fixed scale," said Holmes coldly. "I do not vary them, save when I remit them altogether."
"Well, if dollars make no difference to you, think of the reputation. If you pull this off, every paper in England and America will be booming you. You'll be the talk of two continents."
"Thank you, Mr. Gibson. I do not think that I am in need of booming. It may surprise you to know that I prefer to work anonymously, and that it is the problem itself which attracts me. But we are wasting time. Let us get down to the facts."
"I think that you will find all the main ones in the press reports. I don't know that I can add anything which will help you, but if there is anything you would wish more light upon, well, I am here to give it."
"Well, there is just one point."
"What is it?"
"What were the exact relations between you and Miss Dunbar?"
The Gold King gave a violent start and half rose from his chair. Then his massive calm came back to him. "I suppose you are within your rights and may be doing your duty in asking such a question, Mr. Holmes."
"We will agree to suppose so," said Holmes.
"Then I can assure you that our relations were entirely and always those of an employer towards a young lady whom he never conversed with or ever saw save when she was in the company of his children."
Holmes rose from his chair. "I am a rather busy man, Mr. Gibson," said he, "and I have no time or taste for aimless conversations. I wish you good morning."
Our visitor had risen also, and his great loose figure towered above Holmes. There was an angry gleam from under those bristling brows, and a tinge of colour in the sallow cheeks. "What the devil do you mean by this, Mr. Holmes? Do you dismiss my case?"
"Well, Mr. Gibson, at least I dismiss you.
I should have thought my words were plain." "Plain enough, but what's at the back of it? Raising the price on me, or afraid to tackle it, or what? I've a right to a plain answer."
"Well, perhaps you have," said Holmes. "I'll give you one. This case is quite sufficiently complicated to start with, without the further difficulty of false information."
"Meaning that I lie?"
"Well, I was trying to express it as delicately as I could, but if you insist upon the word, I will not contradict you."
I sprang to my feet, for the expression upon the millionaire's face was fiendish in its intensity, and he had raised his great knotted fist. Holmes smiled languidly and reached his hand out for his pipe.
"Don't be noisy, Mr. Gibson. I find that after breakfast even the smallest argument is unsettling. I suggest that a stroll in the morning air and a little quiet thought will be greatly to your advantage."
With an effort, the Gold King mastered his fury. I could not but admire him, for by a supreme self-command he had turned in a minute from a hot flame of anger to a frigid and contemptuous indifference.
"Well, it's your choice. I guess you know how to run your own business. I can't make you touch the case against your will.
You've done yourself no good this morning, Mr. Holmes, for I have broken stronger men than you. No man ever crossed me and was the better for it."
"So many have said so, and yet here I am," said Holmes, smiling. "Well, good morning, Mr. Gibson. You have a good deal yet to learn."
Our visitor made a noisy exit, but Holmes smoked in imperturbable silence with dreamy eyes fixed upon the ceiling.
"Any views, Watson?" he asked at last.
"Well, Holmes, I Must confess that when I consider that this is a man who would certainly brush any obstacle from his path, and when I remember that his wife may have been an obstacle and an object of dislike, as that man Bates plainly told us, it seems to me...
Exactly. And to me also.
But what were his relations with the governess, and how did you discover them?
Bluff, Watson, bluff.
When I considered the passionate, unconventional, unbusinesslike tone of his letter, and contrasted it with his self-contained manner and appearance, it was pretty clear that there was some deep emotion which centred upon the accused woman rather than upon the victim. We've got to understand the exact relations of those three people if we are to reach the truth. You saw the frontal attack which I made upon him, and how imperturbably he received it. Then I bluffed him by giving him the impression that I was absolutely certain, when in reality I was only extremely suspicious.
Perhaps he will come back.
He is sure to come back. He must come back. He can't leave it where it is. Ha! Isn't that a ring? Yes, there is his footstep. Well, Mr. Gibson, I was just saying to Dr. Watson that you were somewhat overdue. The Gold King had re-entered the room in a more chastened mood than he had left it. His wounded pride still showed in his resentful eyes, but his common sense had shown him that he must yield if he would attain his end.
I've been thinking it over, Mr. Holmes, and I feel that I've been hasty in taking your remarks amiss. You are justified in getting down to the facts, wherever they may be, and I think the more of you for it. I can assure you, however, that the relations between Miss Dunbar and me don't really touch this case.
That is for me to decide, is it not?
Yes, I guess that is so. You're like a surgeon who wants every symptom before he can give his diagnosis.
Exactly. That expresses it. And it is only a patient who has an object in deceiving his surgeon who would conceal the facts of his case.
That may be so, but you will admit, Mr. Holmes, that most men would shy off a bit when they are asked point-blank what their relations with a woman may be, if there is really some serious feeling in the case. I guess most men have a little private reserve of their own in some corner of their souls, where they don't welcome intruders, and you burst suddenly into it. But the object excuses you, since it was to try and save her. Well, the stakes are down and the reserve open, and you can explore where you will. What is it you want?
The truth? The Gold King paused for a moment as one who marshals his thoughts. His grim, deep-lined face had become even sadder and more grave.
"I can give it to you in a very few words, Mr. Holmes," said he at last. "There are some things that are painful as well as difficult to say, so I won't go deeper than is needful. I met my wife when I was gold-hunting in Brazil. Maria Pinto was the daughter of a government official at Manaus, and she was very beautiful. I was young and ardent in those days. But even now, as I look back with colder blood and a more critical eye, I can see that she was rare and wonderful in her beauty. It was a deep, rich nature, too, passionate, wholehearted, tropical, ill-balanced, very different from the American women whom I had known. Well, to make a long story short, I loved her and I married her. It was only when the romance had passed, and it lingered for years, that I realized that we had nothing, absolutely nothing in common. My love faded. If hers had faded also, it might have been easier. But you know the wonderful way of women. Do what I might, nothing could turn her from me. If I had been harsh to her, even brutal, as some have said, it has been because I knew that if I could kill her love, or if it turned to hate, it would be easier for both of us. But nothing changed her. She adored me in those English woods as she had adored me 20 years ago on the banks of the Amazon. Do what I might, she was as devoted as ever. Then came Miss Grace Dunbar.
She answered our advertisement and became governess to our two children. Perhaps you have seen her portrait in the papers. The whole world has proclaimed that she also is a very beautiful woman. Now, I make no pretense to be more moral than my neighbors, and I will admit to you that I could not live under the same roof with such a woman and in daily contact with her without feeling a passionate regard for her. Do you blame me, Mr. Holmes? I do not blame you for feeling it. I should blame you if you expressed it, since this young lady was, in a sense, under your protection. Well, maybe so, said the millionaire, though for a moment the reproof had brought the old angry gleam into his eyes. I'm not pretending to be any better than I am. I guess all my life I've been a man that reached out his hand for what he wanted, and I never wanted anything more than the love and possession of that woman. I told her so. Oh, you did you? Holmes could look very formidable when he was moved. I said to her that if I could marry her, I would, but that it was out of my power. I said that money was no object, and that all I could do to make her happy and comfortable would be done. Very generous, I am sure, said Holmes with a sneer. See here, Mr. Holmes, I came to you on a question of evidence, not on a question of morals. I'm not asking for your criticism. It is only for the young lady's sake that I touch your case at all, said Holmes sternly. I don't know that anything she is accused of is really worse than what you have yourself admitted, that you have tried to ruin a defenseless girl who was under your roof. Some of you rich men have to be taught that all the world cannot be bribed into condoning your offences. To my surprise, the Gold King took the reproof with equanimity. That's how I feel myself about it now. I thank God that my plans did not work out as I intended, and she would have none of it. She wanted to leave the house instantly. Why did she not? Well, in the first place, others were dependent upon her. It was no light matter for her to let them all down by sacrificing her living. When I had sworn, as I did, that she should never be molested again, she consented to remain. But there was another reason. She knew the influence she had over me, and that it was stronger than any other influence in the world. She wanted to use it for good. How? Well, she knew something of my affairs. They're large, Mr. Holmes, large beyond the belief of an ordinary man. I can make or break, and it is usually break. It wasn't individuals only. It was communities, cities, even nations. Business is a hard game, and the weak go to the wall. I played the game for all it was worth. I never squealed myself, and I never cared if the other fellow squealed. She saw it different. I guess she was right. She believed and said that a fortune for one man that was more than he needed should not be built on 10,000 ruined men who were left without the means of life. That was how she saw it, and I guess she could see past the dollars to something that was more lasting. She found that I listened to what she said, and she believed she was serving the world by influencing my actions. So she stayed. And then this came along. Can you throw any light upon that? The Gold King paused for a minute or more, his head sunk in his hands, lost in deep thought. It's very black against her, I can't deny that. And women lead an inward life, and may do things beyond the judgment of a man. At first I was so rattled and taken aback that I was ready to think she had been led away in some extraordinary fashion that was clean against her usual nature. One explanation came into my head. I give it to you, Mr. Holmes, for what it is worth. There is no doubt that my wife was bitterly jealous. There is a soul jealousy that can be as frantic as any body jealousy, and though my wife had no cause, and I think she understood this for the latter, she was aware that this English girl
exerted an influence upon my mind and my acts that she herself never had. It was an influence for good, but that did not mend the matter. She was crazy with hatred, and the heat of the Amazon was always in her blood. She might have planned to murder Miss Dunbar, or we will say to threaten her with a gun and so frighten her into leaving us. Then there might have been a scuffle, and the gun gone off and shot the woman who held it. That possibility had already occurred to me, said Holmes. Indeed, it is the only obvious alternative to deliberate murder. But she utterly denies it. Well, that is not final, is it? One can understand that a woman placed in so awful a position might hurry home, still in her bewilderment, holding the revolver. She might even throw it down among her clothes, hardly knowing what she was doing. And when it was found, she might try to lie her way out by a total denial, since all explanation was impossible. What is against such a supposition? Miss Dunbar herself. Well, perhaps. Holmes looked at his watch. I have no doubt we can get the necessary permits this morning and reach Winchester by the evening train. When I have seen this young lady, it is very possible that I may be of more use to you in the matter, though I cannot promise that my conclusions will necessarily be such as you desire. There was some delay in the official pass, and instead of reaching Winchester that day, we went down to Thor Place, the Hampshire estate of Mr. Neil Gibson. He did not accompany us himself, but we had the address of Sergeant Coventry of the local police, who had first examined into the affair. He was a tall, thin, cadaverous man with a secretive and mysterious manner, which conveyed the idea that he knew or suspected a very great deal more than he dared say. He had a trick, too, of suddenly sinking his voice to a whisper, as if he had come upon something of vital importance, though the information was usually commonplace enough. Behind these tricks of manner, he soon showed himself to be a decent, honest fellow who was not too proud to admit that he was out of his depth and would welcome any help. "Anyhow, I'd rather have you than Scotland Yard, Mr. Holmes," said he. "If the Yard gets called into a case, then the local loses all credit for success and may be blamed for failure. Now you play straight, so I've heard." "I need not appear in the matter at all," said Holmes, to the evident relief of our melancholy acquaintance. "If I can clear it up, I don't ask to have my name mentioned." "Well, it's very handsome of you, I am sure. And your friend Dr. Watson can be trusted, I know. Now, Mr. Holmes, as we walk down to the place, there is one question I should like to ask you. I'd breathe it to no soul but you." He looked round as though he hardly dare utter the words. "Don't you think there might be a case against Mr. Neil Gibson himself?"
"I have been considering that."
"You've not seen Miss Dunbar. She is a wonderful fine woman in every way. He may well have wished his wife out of the road, and these Americans are readier with pistols than our folk are. It was his pistol, you know."
"Was that clearly made out?"
"Yes, sir. It was one of a pair that he had."
"One of a pair? Where is the other?"
"Well, the gentleman has a lot of firearms of one sort and another. We never quite matched that particular pistol, but the box was made for two."
"If it was one of a pair, you should surely be able to match it."
"Well, we have them all laid out at the house, if you would care to look them over."
"Later, perhaps. I think we will walk down together and have a look at the scene of the tragedy."
This conversation had taken place in the little front room of Sergeant Coventry's humble cottage, which served as the local police station. A walk of half a mile or so across a wind-swept heath, all gold and bronze with the fading ferns, brought us to a side gate opening into the grounds of the Thor Place estate. A path led us through the pheasant preserves, and then, from a clearing, we saw the widespread, half-timbered house, half Tudor and half Georgian, upon the crest of the hill. Beside us there was a long, reedy pool, constricted in the centre, where the main carriage drive passed over a stone bridge, but swelling into small lakes on either side. Our guide paused at the mouth of this bridge, and he pointed to the ground. That was where Mrs. Gibson's body lay. I marked it by that stone. I understand that you were there before it was moved. Yes, they sent for me at once.
Who did?
Mr. Gibson himself. The moment the alarm was given, and he had rushed down with others from the house, he insisted that nothing should be moved until the police should arrive.
That was sensible. I gathered from the newspaper report that the shot was fired from close quarters?
Yes, sir. Very close. Near the right temple. Just behind it, sir.
How did the body lie?
On the back, sir. No trace of a struggle, no marks, no weapon. The short note from Miss Dunbar was clutched in her left hand.
Clutched, you say?
Yes, sir. We could hardly open the fingers. That is of great importance. It excludes the idea that anyone could have placed the note there after death in order to furnish a false clue. Dear me. The note, as I remember, was quite short. I will be at Thorbridge at 9 o'clock, G. Dunbar. Was that not so?
Yes, sir.
Did Miss Dunbar admit writing it?
Yes, sir.
What was her explanation? Her defence was reserved for the assizes. She would say nothing.
The problem is certainly a very interesting one. The point of the letter is very obscure, is it not?
Well, sir, said the guide, it seemed, if I may be so bold as to say so, the only really clear point in the whole case. Holmes shook his head. Granting that the letter is genuine and was really written, it was certainly received some time before, say, 1 hour or two. Why, then, was this lady still clasping it in her left hand? Why should she carry it so carefully? She did not need to refer to it in the interview. Does it not seem remarkable?
Well, sir, as you put it, perhaps it does.
I think I should like to sit quietly for a few minutes and think it out. He seated himself upon the stone ledge of the bridge, and I could see his quick grey eyes darting their questioning glances in every direction. Suddenly he sprang up again and ran across to the opposite parapet, whipped his lens from his pocket, and began to examine the stonework.
"This is curious," said he.
"Yes, sir, we saw the chip on the ledge. I expect it's been done by some passer-by." The stonework was grey, but at this one point it showed white for a space not larger than a sixpence. When examined closely, one could see that the surface was chipped as by a sharp blow.
"It took some violence to do that," said Holmes thoughtfully.
With his cane he struck the ledge several times without leaving a mark.
"Yes, it was a hard knock, in a curious place, too. It was not from above, but from below, for you see that it is on the lower edge of the parapet.
But it is at least 15 feet from the body."
"Yes, it is 15 feet from the body. It may have nothing to do with the matter, but it is a point worth noting.
I do not think that we have anything more to learn here. There were no footsteps, you say?"
"The ground was iron hard, sir. There were no traces at all."
"Then we can go. We will go up to the house first and look over these weapons of which you speak. Then we shall get on to Winchester, for I should desire to see Miss Dunbar before we go farther." Mr. Neil Gibson had not returned from town, but we saw in the house the neurotic Mr. Bates, who had called upon us in the morning. He showed us with a sinister relish the formidable array of firearms of various shapes and sizes which his employer had accumulated in the course of an adventurous life. Mr. Gibson has his enemies, as anyone would expect who knew him and his methods, said he. He sleeps with a loaded revolver in the drawer beside his bed. He is a man of violence, sir, and there are times when all of us are afraid of him. I am sure that the poor lady who has passed was often terrified.
Did you ever witness physical violence towards her?
No, I cannot say that, but I have heard words which were nearly as bad, words of cold, cutting contempt, even before the servants. "'Our millionaire does not seem to shine in private life,' remarked Holmes as we made our way to the station. "'Well, Watson, we have come on a good many facts, some of them new ones, and yet I seem some way from my conclusion. In spite of the very evident dislike which Mr. Bates has to his employer, I gather from him that when the alarm came he was undoubtedly in his library.' Dinner was over at 8:30, and all was normal up to then. It is true that the alarm was somewhat late in the evening, but the tragedy certainly occurred about the hour named in the note. There is no evidence at all that Mr. Gibson had been out of doors since his return from town at 5 o'clock. On the other hand, Miss Dunbar, as I understand it, admits that she had made an appointment to meet Mrs. Gibson at the bridge. Beyond this, she would say nothing, as her lawyer had advised her to reserve her defence. We have several very vital questions to ask that young lady, and my mind will not be easy until we have seen her. I must confess that the case would seem to me to be very black against her, if it were not for one thing.
And what is that, Holmes?
The finding of the pistol in her wardrobe.
Dear me, Holmes, I cried. That seemed to me to be the most damning incident of all.
Not so, Watson. It had struck me, even at my first perfunctory reading, as very strange. And now that I am in closer touch with the case, it is my only firm ground for hope. We must look for consistency. Where there is a want of it, we must suspect deception.
I hardly follow you.
Well, now, Watson, suppose for a moment that we visualize you in the character of a woman who, in a cold, premeditated fashion, is about to get rid of a rival. You have planned it. A note has been written. The victim has come. You have your weapon. The crime is done. It has been workmanlike and complete. Do you tell me that after carrying out so crafty a crime, you would now ruin your reputation as a criminal by forgetting to fling your weapon into those adjacent reed beds which would forever cover it? But you must needs carry it carefully home and put it in your own wardrobe, the very first place that would be searched? Your best friends would hardly call you a schemer, Watson, and yet I could not picture you doing anything so crude as that.
In the excitement of the moment.
No, no, Watson, I will not admit that it is possible. Where a crime is coolly premeditated, then the means of covering it are coolly premeditated also. I hope, therefore, that we are in the presence of a serious misconception.
But there is so much to explain.
Well, we shall set about explaining it. When once your point of view is changed, the very thing which was so damning becomes a clue to the truth. For example, there is this revolver. Miss Dunbar disclaims all knowledge of it. On our new theory, she is speaking truth when she says so. Therefore, it was placed in her wardrobe. Who placed it there? Someone who wished to incriminate her. Was not that person the actual criminal? You see how we come at once upon a most fruitful line of inquiry. We were compelled to spend the night at Winchester, as the formalities had not yet been completed. But next morning, in the company of Mr. Joyce Cummings, the rising barrister who was entrusted with the defence, we were allowed to see the young lady in her cell. I had expected, from all that we had heard, to see a beautiful woman. But I can never forget the effect which Miss Dunbar produced upon me. It was no wonder that even the masterful millionaire had found in her something more powerful than himself, something which could control and guide him. One felt, too, as one looked at the strong, clear-cut and yet sensitive face, that even should she be capable of some impetuous deed, none the less there was an innate nobility of character which would make her influence always for the good. She was a brunette, tall, with a noble figure and commanding presence, but her dark eyes had in them the appealing, helpless expression of the hunted creature who feels the nets around it, but can see no way out from the toils.
Now, as she realized the presence and the help of my famous friend, there came a touch of colour to her wan cheeks, and a light of hope began to glimmer in the glance which she turned upon us.
"Perhaps Mr. Neil Gibson has told you something of what occurred between us?" she asked in a low, agitated voice.
"Yes," Holmes answered. "You need not pain yourself by entering into that part of the story. After seeing you, I am prepared to accept Mr. Gibson's statement, both as to the influence which you had over him and as to the innocence of your relations with him. But why was the whole situation not brought out in court?"
"It seemed to me incredible that such a charge could be sustained. I thought that if we waited, the whole thing must clear itself up without our being compelled to enter into painful details of the inner life of the family. But I understand that far from clearing, it has become even more serious."
"My dear young lady," cried Holmes earnestly, "I beg you to have no illusions upon the point. Mr. Cummings here would assure you that all the cards are at present against us, and that we must do everything that is possible if we are to win clear. It would be a cruel deception to pretend that you are not in very great danger. Give me all the help you can, then, to get at the truth."
"I will conceal nothing."
"Tell us, then, of your true relations with Mr. Gibson's wife."
"She hated me, Mr. Holmes. She hated me with all the fervour of her tropical nature. She was a woman who would do nothing by halves, and the measure of her love for her husband was the measure also of her hatred for me. It is probable that she misunderstood our relations. I would not wish to wrong her, but she loved so vividly in a physical sense that she could hardly understand the mental and even spiritual tie which held her husband to me, or imagine that it was only my desire to influence his power to good ends which kept me under his roof. I can see now that I was wrong. Nothing could justify me in remaining where I was a cause of unhappiness, and yet it is certain that the unhappiness would have remained even if I had left the house.
Now, Miss Dunbar," said Holmes, "I beg you to tell us exactly what occurred that evening."
"I can tell you the truth so far as I know it, Mr. Holmes, but I am in a position to prove nothing, and there are points, the most vital points, which I can neither explain nor can I imagine any explanation."
"If you will find the facts, perhaps others may find the explanation."
"With regard, then, to my presence at Thor Bridge that night. I received a note from Mrs. Gibson in the morning. It lay on the table of the schoolroom, and it may have been left there by her own hand. It implored me to see her there after dinner, said she had something important to say to me, and asked me to leave an answer on the sundial in the garden, as she desired no one to be in our confidence. I saw no reason for such secrecy, but I did as she asked, accepting the appointment. She asked me to destroy her note, and I burned it in the schoolroom grate. She was very much afraid of her husband, who treated her with a harshness for which I frequently reproached him, and I could only imagine that she acted in this way because she did not wish him to know of our interview."
"Yet she kept your reply very carefully."
"Yes, I was surprised to hear that she had it in her hand when she died."
"Well, what happened then?"
"I went down as I had promised. When I reached the bridge, she was waiting for me. Never did I realize till that moment how this poor creature hated me. She was like a madwoman. Indeed, I think she was a madwoman. Subtly mad, with the deep power of deception which insane people may have. How else could she have met me with unconcern every day, and yet had so raging a hatred of me in her heart? I will not say what she said. She poured her whole wild fury out in burning and horrible words. I did not even answer. I could not. It was dreadful to see her. I put my hands to my ears and rushed away. When I left her, she was standing, still shrieking out her curses at me, in the mouth of the bridge."
"Where she was afterwards found?"
within a few yards from the spot.
And yet, presuming that she had met her death shortly after you left her,
you heard no shot?
No, I heard nothing. But indeed, Mr. Holmes, I was so agitated and horrified by this terrible outbreak that I rushed to get back to the peace of my own room, and I was incapable of noticing anything which happened.
You say that you returned to your room. Did you leave it again before next morning?
Yes, when the alarm came that the poor creature had met her death, I ran out with the others.
Did you see Mr. Gibson?
Yes, he had just returned from the bridge when I saw him. He had sent for the doctor and the police.
Did he seem to you much perturbed?
Mr. Gibson is a very strong, self-contained man. I do not think that he would ever show his emotions on the surface. But I, who knew him so well, could see that he was deeply concerned.
Then we come to the all-important point. This pistol that was found in your room, had you ever seen it before?
Never, I swear it.
When was it found?
Next morning, when the police made their search.
Among your clothes?
Yes, on the floor of my wardrobe, under my dresses.
You could not guess how long it had been there.
It had not been there the morning before.
How do you know?
Because I tidied out the wardrobe.
That is final. Then someone came into your room and placed the pistol there in order to inculpate you.
It must have been so.
And when?
It could only have been at mealtime, or else at the hours when I would be in the schoolroom with the children.
As you were when you got the note?
Yes, from that time onward for the whole morning.
Thank you, Miss Dunbar. Is there any other point which could help me in the investigation?
I can think of none.
There was some sign of violence on the stonework of the bridge, a perfectly fresh chip just opposite the body. Could you suggest any possible explanation of that?
Surely it must be a mere coincidence.
Curious, Miss Dunbar, very curious. Why should it appear the very time of the tragedy, and why at the very place?
But what could have caused it? Only great violence could have such an effect.
Holmes did not answer.
His pale, eager face had suddenly assumed that tense, faraway expression which I had learned to associate with the supreme manifestations of his genius. So evident was the crisis in his mind that none of us dared to speak, and we sat, barrister, prisoner, and myself, watching him in a concentrated and absorbed silence. Suddenly he sprang from his chair, vibrating with nervous energy and the pressing need for action.
"Come, Watson, come!" he cried.
"What is it, Mr. Holmes?"
"Never mind, my dear lady. You will hear from me, Mr. Cummings. With the help of the God of Justice, I will give you a case which will make England ring. You will get news by tomorrow, Miss Dunbar, and meanwhile, take my assurance that the clouds are lifting, and that I have every hope that the light of truth is breaking through." It was not a long journey from Winchester to Thorpe Place, but it was long to me in my impatience, while for Holmes it was evident that it seemed endless, for in his nervous restlessness he could not sit still, but paced the carriage, or drummed with his long, sensitive fingers upon the cushions beside him. Suddenly, however, as we neared our destination, he seated himself opposite to me — we had a first-class carriage to ourselves — and laying a hand upon each of my knees, he looked into my eyes with the peculiarly mischievous gaze which was characteristic of his more imp-like moods. "Watson," said he, "I have some recollection that you go armed upon these excursions of ours." It was as well for him that I did so, for he took little care for his own safety when his mind was once absorbed by a problem, so that more than once my revolver had been a good friend in need. I reminded him of the fact. "Yes, yes, I am a little absent-minded in such matters, but have you your revolver on you?" I produced it from my hip pocket, a short, handy, but very serviceable little weapon.
He undid the catch, shook out the cartridges, and examined it with care. "It's heavy, remarkably heavy," said he. "Yes, it's a solid bit of work." He mused over it for a minute. "Do you know, Watson," said he, "I believe your revolver is going to have a very intimate connection with the mystery which we are investigating."
"My dear Holmes, you are joking."
"No, Watson, I'm very serious. There is a test before us. If the test comes off, all will be clear, and the test will depend upon the conduct of this little weapon." One cartridge out. Now we will replace the other five and put on the safety catch. So, that increases the weight and makes it a better reproduction." I had no glimmer of what was in his mind, nor did he enlighten me, but sat lost in thought until we pulled up in the little Hampshire station. We secured a ramshackle trap, and in a quarter of an hour were at the house of our confidential friend, the sergeant. "A clue, Mr. Holmes? What is it?"
"It all depends upon the behaviour of Dr. Watson's revolver," said my friend. "Here it is. Now, officer, can you give me 10 yards of string?"
The village shop provided a ball of stout twine. "I think that this is all we will need," said Holmes. "Now, if you please, we will get off on what I hope is the last stage of our journey."
The sun was setting and turning the rolling Hampshire moor into a wonderful autumnal panorama. The sergeant, with many critical and incredulous glances, which showed his deep doubts of the sanity of my companion, lurched along beside us. As we approached the scene of the crime, I could see that my friend, under all his habitual coolness, was, in truth, deeply agitated. "Yes," he said in answer to my remark, "you have seen me miss my mark before, Watson. I have an instinct for such things, and yet it has sometimes played me false. It seemed a certainty when first it flashed across my mind in the cell at Winchester. But one drawback of an active mind is that one can always conceive alternative explanations which would make our scent a false one. And yet... Well, Watson, we can but try." As he walked, he had firmly tied one end of the string to the handle of the revolver. We had now reached the scene of the tragedy. With great care, he marked out, under the guidance of the policeman, the exact spot where the body had been stretched. He then hunted among the heather and the ferns until he found a considerable stone. This he secured to the other end of his line of string, and he hung it over the parapet of the bridge, so that it swung clear above the water. He then stood on the fatal spot, some distance from the edge of the bridge, with my revolver in his hand, the string being taut between the weapon and the heavy stone on the farther side. "Now for it!" he cried. At the words, he raised the pistol to his head, and then let go his grip. In an instant, it had been whisked away by the weight of the stone, had struck with a sharp crack against the parapet, and had vanished over the side into the water. It had hardly gone before Holmes was kneeling beside the stonework, and a joyous cry showed that he had found what he expected. "Was there ever a more exact demonstration?" he cried. "See, Watson, your revolver has solved the problem." As he spoke, he pointed to a second chip of the exact size and shape of the first, which had appeared on the under edge of the stone balustrade. "We'll stay at the inn tonight," he continued, as he rose and faced the astonished sergeant. "You will, of course, get a grappling hook, and you will easily restore my friend's revolver. You will also find beside it the revolver, string, and weight with which this vindictive woman attempted to disguise her own crime and to fasten a charge of murder upon an innocent victim. You can let Mr. Gibson know that I will see him in the morning, when steps can be taken for Miss Dunbar's vindication." Late that evening, as we sat together smoking our pipes in the village inn, Holmes gave me a brief review of what had passed.
"I fear, Watson," said he, "that you will not improve any reputation which I may have acquired by adding the case of the Thor Bridge mystery to your annals. I have been sluggish in mind, and wanting in that mixture of imagination and reality which is the basis of my art. I confess that the chip in the stonework was a sufficient clue to suggest the true solution, and that I blame myself for not having attained it sooner. It must be admitted that the workings of this unhappy woman's mind were deep and subtle, so that it was no very simple matter to unravel her plot. I do not think that in our adventures we have ever come across a stranger example of what perverted love can bring about. Whether Miss Dunbar was her rival in a physical or in a merely mental sense seems to have been equally unforgivable in her eyes. No doubt she blamed this innocent lady for all those harsh dealings and unkind words with which her husband tried to repel her too demonstrative affection. Her first resolution was to end her own life. Her second was to do it in such a way as to involve her victim in a fate which was worse far than any sudden death could be. We can follow the various steps quite clearly, and they show a remarkable subtlety of mind. A note was extracted very cleverly from Miss Dunbar, which would make it appear that she had chosen the scene of the crime. In her anxiety that it should be discovered, she somewhat overdid it by holding it in her hand to the last. This alone should have excited my suspicions earlier than it did. Then she took one of her husband's revolvers. There was, as you saw, an arsenal in the house, and kept it for her own use. A similar one she concealed that morning in Miss Dunbar's wardrobe, after discharging one barrel, which she could easily do in the woods without attracting attention. Then she went down to the bridge, where she had contrived this exceedingly ingenious method for getting rid of her weapon. When Miss Dunbar appeared, she used her last breath in pouring out her hatred, and then, when she was out of hearing, carried out her terrible purpose. Every link is now in its place, and the chain is complete. The papers may ask why the mirror was not dragged in the first instance, but it is easy to be wise after the event, and in any case the expanse of a reed-filled lake is no easy matter to drag, unless you have a clear perception of what you are looking for and where. Well, Watson, we have helped a remarkable woman and also a formidable man. Should they in the future join their forces, as seems not unlikely, the financial world may find that Mr. Neil Gibson has learned something in that schoolroom of sorrow where our earthly lessons are taught. The Adventure of the Creeping Man. Mr. Sherlock Holmes was always of opinion that I should publish the singular facts connected with Professor Presbrey, if only to dispel, once for all, the ugly rumours which some 20 years ago agitated the university and were echoed in the learned societies of London. There were, however, certain obstacles in the way, and the true history of this curious case remained entombed in the tin box which contains so many records of my friend's adventures. Now we have at last obtained permission to ventilate the facts which formed one of the very last cases handled by Holmes before his retirement from practice. Even now, a certain reticence and discretion have to be observed in laying the matter before the public. It was one Sunday evening, early in September of the year 1903, that I received one of Holmes's laconic messages. "Come at once, if convenient. If inconvenient, come all the same. S.H." The relations between us in those latter days were peculiar. He was a man of habits, narrow and concentrated habits, and I had become one of them.
As an institution, I was like the violin, the shag tobacco, the old black pipe, the index books, and others perhaps less excusable. When it was a case of active work and a comrade was needed upon whose nerve he could place some reliance, my role was obvious. But apart from this, I had uses. I was a whetstone for his mind. I stimulated him. He liked to think aloud in my presence. His remarks could hardly be said to be made to me. Many of them would have been as appropriately addressed to his bedstead. But nonetheless, having formed the habit, it had become in some way helpful that I should register and interject. If I irritated him by a certain methodical slowness in my mentality, that irritation served only to make his own flame-like intuitions and impressions flash up the more vividly and swiftly. Such was my humble role in our alliance. When I arrived at Baker Street, I found him huddled up in his armchair, with updrawn knees, his pipe in his mouth, and his brow furrowed with thought. It was clear that he was in the throes of some vexatious problem. With a wave of his hand, he indicated my old armchair, but otherwise, for half an hour, he gave no sign that he was aware of my presence. Then, with a start, he seemed to come from his reverie, and with his usual whimsical smile, he greeted me back to what had once been my home. "You will excuse a certain abstraction of mind, my dear Watson," said he. "Some curious facts have been submitted to me within the last 24 hours, and they in turn have given rise to some speculations of a more general character. I have serious thoughts of writing a small monograph upon the uses of dogs in the work of the detective."
"But surely, Holmes, this has been explored," said I. "Bloodhounds, sleuth-hounds—"
"No, no, Watson. That side of the matter is, of course, obvious. There is another which is far more subtle. You may recollect that in the case which you, in your sensational way, coupled with the copper beeches, I was able, by watching the mind of the child, to form a deduction as to the criminal habits of the very smug and respectable father."
"Yes, I remember it well."
"My line of thoughts about dogs is analogous. A dog reflects the family life. Whoever saw a frisky dog in a gloomy family, or a sad dog in a happy one? Snarling people have snarling dogs, dangerous people have dangerous dogs, and their passing moods may reflect the passing moods of others."
I shook my head. "Surely, Holmes, this is a little far-fetched," said I.
He had refilled his pipe and resumed his seat, taking no notice of my comment. "The practical application of what I have said is very close to the problem which I am investigating. It is a tangled skein, you understand, and I am looking for a loose end. One possible loose end lies in the question, why does Professor Presbury's wolfhound Roy endeavour to bite him?"
I sank back in my chair in some disappointment. Was it for so trivial a question as this that I had been summoned from my work? Holmes glanced across at me.
"The same old Watson," said he. "You never learn that the gravest issues may depend upon the smallest things.
But is it not, on the face of it, strange that a staid, elderly philosopher—you've heard of Presbury, of course, the famous Camford physiologist—that such a man, whose friend has been his devoted wolfhound, should now have been twice attacked by his own dog? What do you make of it?"
"The dog is ill."
"Well, that has to be considered. But he attacks no one else, nor does he apparently molest his master, save on very special occasions. Curious, Watson, very curious. But young Mr. Bennett is before his time, if that is his ring. I had hoped to have a longer chat with you before he came." There was a quick step on the stairs, a sharp tap at the door, and a moment later the new client presented himself. He was a tall, handsome youth, about 30, well-dressed and elegant,
but with something in his bearing which suggested the shyness of the student rather than the self-possession of the man of the world. He shook hands with Holmes and then looked with surprise at me.
"This matter is very delicate, Mr. Holmes," he said. "Consider the relation in which I stand to Professor Presbrey, both privately and publicly. I really can hardly justify myself if I speak before any third person."
"Have no fear, Mr. Bennet. Dr. Watson is the very soul of discretion, and I can assure you that this is a matter in which I am very likely to need an assistant."
"As you like, Mr. Holmes. You will, I am sure, understand my having some reserves in the matter."
"You will appreciate it, Watson, when I tell you that this gentleman, Mr. Trevor Bennet, is professional assistant to the great scientist, lives under his roof, and is engaged to his only daughter. Certainly we must agree that the professor has every claim upon his loyalty and devotion, but it may best be shown by taking the necessary steps to clear up this strange mystery."
"I hope so, Mr. Holmes. That is my one object. Does Dr. Watson know the situation?"
"I have not had time to explain it."
"Then perhaps I had better go over the ground again before explaining some fresh developments."
"I will do so myself," said Holmes, "in order to show that I have the events in their due order. The professor, Watson, is a man of European reputation. His life has been academic. There has never been a breath of scandal. He is a widower with one daughter, Edith. He is, I gather, a man of very virile and positive, one might say almost combative, character. So the matter stood until a very few months ago. Then the current of his life was broken. He is 61 years of age, but he became engaged to the daughter of Professor Morphy, his colleague in the chair of comparative anatomy. It was not, as I understand, the reasoned courting of an elderly man, but rather the passionate frenzy of youth, for no one could have shown himself a more devoted lover. The lady, Alice Morphy, was a very perfect girl both in mind and body, so that there was every excuse for the professor's infatuation. Nonetheless, it did not meet with full approval in his own family."
"We thought it rather excessive," said our visitor.
"Exactly. Excessive and a little violent and unnatural. Professor Presbrey was rich, however, and there was no objection upon the part of the father. The daughter, however, had other views, and there were already several candidates for her hand who, if they were less eligible from a worldly point of view, were at least more of an age. The girl seemed to like the professor in spite of his eccentricities. It was only age which stood in the way. About this time, a little mystery suddenly clouded the normal routine of the professor's life. He did what he had never done before. He left home and gave no indication where he was going. He was away a fortnight and returned looking rather travel-worn. He made no allusion to where he had been, although he was usually the frankest of men. It chanced, however, that our client here, Mr. Bennet, received a letter from a fellow student in Prague, who said that he was glad to have seen Professor Presbrey there, although he had not been able to talk to him. Only in this way did his own household learn where he had been. Now comes the point. From that time onward, a curious change came over the professor. He became furtive and sly. Those around him had always the feeling that he was not the man that they had known, but that he was under some shadow which had darkened his higher qualities. His intellect was not affected. His lectures were as brilliant as ever, but always there was something new, something sinister and unexpected. His daughter, who was devoted to him, tried again and again to resume the old relations and to penetrate this mask which her father seemed to have put on. You, sir, as I understand, did the same, but all was in vain. And now, Mr. Bennet, tell in your own words the incident of the letters."
"You must understand, Dr. Watson, that the professor had no secrets from me. If I were his son or his younger brother, I could not have more completely enjoyed his confidence. As his secretary, I handled every paper which came to him, and I opened and subdivided his letters. Shortly after his return, all this was changed. He told me that certain letters might come to him from London which would be marked by a cross under the stamp. These were to be set aside for his own eyes only. I may say that several of these did pass through my hands, that they had the EC mark, and were in an illiterate handwriting. If he answered them at all, the answers did not pass through my hands, nor into the letter basket in which our correspondence was collected.
"And the box?" said Holmes.
"Ah, yes, the box. The professor brought back a little wooden box from his travels. It was the one thing which suggested a continental tour, for it was one of those quaint carved things which one associates with Germany. This he placed in his instrument cupboard. One day, in looking for a cannula, I took up the box. To my surprise, he was very angry, and reproved me, in words which were quite savage, for my curiosity. It was the first time such a thing had happened, and I was deeply hurt. I endeavoured to explain that it was a mere accident that I had touched the box, but all the evening I was conscious that he looked at me harshly, and that the incident was rankling in his mind."
Mr. Bennet drew a little diary book from his pocket.
"That was on July the 2nd,
said he.
"You are certainly an admirable witness," said Holmes. "I may need some of these dates which you have noted."
"I learned method, among other things, from my great teacher. From the time that I observed abnormality in his behaviour, I felt that it was my duty to study his case. Thus I have it here that it was on that very day, July the 2nd, that Roy attacked the professor as he came from his study into the hall. Again, on July 11th, there was a scene of the same sort, and then I have a note of yet another upon July the 20th. After that, we had to banish Roy to the stables. He was a dear, affectionate animal. But I fear I weary you?"
Mr. Bennet spoke in a tone of reproach, for it was very clear that Holmes was not listening. His face was rigid, and his eyes gazed abstractedly at the ceiling. With an effort, he recovered himself.
"Singular, most singular," he murmured.
"Now, these details were new to me, Mr. Bennet. I think we have now fairly gone over the old ground, have we not? But you spoke of some fresh developments."
The pleasant, open face of our visitor clouded over, shadowed by some grim remembrance.
"What I speak of occurred the night before last," said he. "I was lying awake about 2 in the morning, when I was aware of a dull, muffled sound coming from the passage. I opened my door and peeped out. I should explain that the professor sleeps at the end of the passage."
"The date being?" asked Holmes.
Our visitor was clearly annoyed at so irrelevant an interruption.
"I have said, sir, that it was the night before last, that is, September the 4th.
Holmes nodded and smiled.
"Pray continue," said he.
"He sleeps at the end of the passage, and would have to pass my door in order to reach the staircase. It was a really terrifying experience, Mr. Holmes. I think that I am as strong-nerved as my neighbours, but I was shaken by what I saw. The passage was dark, save that one window halfway along it threw a patch of light. I could see that something was coming along the passage, something dark and crouching. Then suddenly it emerged into the light, and I saw that it was he. He was crawling, Mr. Holmes. Crawling. He was not quite on his hands and knees. I should rather say on his hands and feet, with his face sunk between his hands. Yet he seemed to move with ease. I was so paralysed by the sight that it was not until he had reached my door that I was able to step forward and ask if I could assist him. His answer was extraordinary. He sprang up, spat out some atrocious word at me, and hurried on past me and down the staircase. I waited about for an hour, but he did not come back. It must have been daylight before he regained his room.
"Well, Watson, what do you make of that?" asked Holmes, with the air of the pathologist who presents a rare specimen. "Lumbago, possibly, I have known a severe attack make a man walk in just such a way, and nothing would be more trying to the temper. Good, Watson, you always keep us flat-footed on the ground, but we can hardly accept lumbago since he was able to stand erect in a moment.
He was never better in health, said Bennett. In fact, he is stronger than I have known him for years. But these are the facts, Mr. Holmes. It is not a case in which we can consult the police, and yet we are utterly at our wits' end as to what to do, and we feel in some strange way that we are drifting towards disaster. Edith, Miss Presbrey, feels as I do, and we cannot wait passively any longer.
It is certainly a very curious and suggestive case. What do you think, Watson?
Speaking as a medical man, said I, it appears to be a case for an alienist. The old gentleman's cerebral processes were disturbed by the love affair. He made a journey abroad in the hope of breaking himself of the passion. His letters and the box may be connected with some other private transaction, a loan, perhaps, or share certificates which are in the box.
And the wolfhound no doubt disapproved of the financial bargain?
No, no, Watson. There is more in it than this. Now, I can only suggest...
What Sherlock Holmes was about to suggest will never be known, for at this moment the door opened and a young lady was shown into the room. As she appeared, Mr. Bennet sprang up with a cry and ran forward with his hands out to meet those which she had herself outstretched.
"Edith, dear, nothing the matter, I hope." "I felt I must follow you. Oh, Jack, I have been so dreadfully frightened. It is awful to be there alone." "Mr. Holmes, this is the young lady I spoke of. This is my fiancée."
We were gradually coming to that conclusion, were we not, Watson? Holmes answered with a smile. "I take it, Miss Presbrey, that there is some fresh development in the case, and that you thought we should know."
Our new visitor, a bright, handsome girl of a conventional English type, smiled back at Holmes as she seated herself beside Mr. Bennet.
"When I found Mr. Bennet had left his hotel, I thought I should probably find him here. Of course, he had told me that he would consult you. But, oh, Mr. Holmes, can you do nothing for my poor father?"
"I have hopes, Miss Presbrey, but the case is still obscure. Perhaps what you have to say may throw some fresh light upon it."
"It was last night, Mr. Holmes. He had been very strange all day. I'm sure that there are times when he has no recollection of what he does. He lives in a strange dream. Yesterday was such a day. It was not my father with whom I lived. His outward shell was there, but it was not really he."
"Tell me what happened."
"I was awakened in the night by the dog barking most furiously. Poor Roy, he is chained now near the stable. I may say that I always sleep with my door locked, for as Mr. Bennet will tell you, we all have a feeling of impending danger. My room is on the second floor. It happened that the blind was up in my window, and there was bright moonlight outside. As I lay with my eyes fixed upon the square of light, listening to the frenzied barkings of the dog, I was amazed to see my father's face looking in at me. Mr. Holmes, I nearly died of surprise and horror. There it was, pressed against the window-pane, and one hand seemed to be raised as if to push up the window. If that window had opened, I think I should have gone mad. It was no delusion, Mr. Holmes. Don't deceive yourself by thinking so. I dare say it was 20 seconds or so that I lay paralyzed and watched the face. Then it vanished. But I could not spring out of bed and look out after it. I lay cold and shivering till morning. At breakfast he was sharp and fierce in manner, and made no allusion to the adventure of the night. Neither did I, but I gave an excuse for coming to town, and here I am."
Holmes looked thoroughly surprised at Miss Presbrey's narrative. "My dear young lady, you say that your room is on the second floor. Is there a long ladder in the garden?"
"No, Mr. Holmes, that is the amazing part of it. There is no possible way of reaching the window, and yet he was there.
The date being September 5th, said Holmes, that certainly complicates matters. It was the young lady's turn to look surprised. This is the second time that you have alluded to the date, Mr. Holmes, said Bennett. Is it possible that it has any bearing upon the case?
It is possible, very possible, and yet I have not my full material at present.
Possibly you are thinking of the connection between insanity and phases of the moon?
No, I assure you, it was quite a different line of thought. Possibly you can leave your notebook with me, and I will check the dates. Now, I think, Watson, that our line of action is perfectly clear. This young lady has informed us, and I have the greatest confidence in her intuition, that her father remembers little or nothing which occurs upon certain dates. We will therefore call upon him as if he had given us an appointment upon such a date. He will put it down to his own lack of memory. Thus we will open our campaign by having a good close view of him.
That is excellent, said Mr. Bennett. I warn you, however, that the professor is irascible and violent at times.
Holmes smiled.
There are reasons why we should come at once, very cogent reasons, if my theories hold good. Tomorrow, Mr. Bennett will certainly see us in Camford. There is, if I remember right, an inn called the Chequers, where the port used to be above mediocrity and the linen was above reproach. I think, Watson, that our lot for the next few days might lie in less pleasant places.
Monday morning found us on our way to the famous university town, an easy effort on the part of Holmes, who had no roots to pull up, but one which involved frantic planning and hurrying on my part, as my practice was by this time not inconsiderable. Holmes made no allusion to the case until after we had deposited our suitcases at the ancient hostel of which he had spoken.
I think, Watson, that we can catch the professor just before lunch. He lectures at 11 and should have an interval at home.
What possible excuse have we for calling?
Holmes glanced at his notebook. There was a period of excitement upon August 26th. We will assume that he is a little hazy as to what he does at such times. If we insist that we are there by appointment, I think he will hardly venture to contradict us. Have you the effrontery necessary to put it through?
We can but try.
Excellent, Watson. Compound of the busy bee and excelsior. We can but try. The motto of the firm. A friendly native will surely guide us.
Such a one, on the back of a smart hansom, swept us past a row of ancient colleges, and finally, turning into a tree-lined drive, pulled up at the door of a charming house, girt round with lawns and covered with purple wisteria. Professor Presbrey was certainly surrounded with every sign not only of comfort but of luxury. Even as we pulled up, a grizzled head appeared at the front window, and we were aware of a pair of keen eyes from under shaggy brows which surveyed us through large horn glasses. A moment later we were actually in his sanctum, and the mysterious scientist whose vagaries had brought us from London was standing before us. There was certainly no sign of eccentricity either in his manner or appearance, for he was a portly, large-featured man, grave, tall, and frock-coated, with the dignity of bearing which a lecturer needs. His eyes were his most remarkable feature, keen, observant, and clever to the verge of cunning. He looked at our cards.
"Pray sit down, gentlemen. What can I do for you?"
Mr. Holmes smiled amiably.
"It was the question which I was about to put to you, Professor."
"To me, sir?"
"Possibly there is some mistake. I heard through a second person that Professor Presbrey of Camford had need of my services."
"Oh, indeed!"
It seemed to me that there was a malicious sparkle in the intense grey eyes.
"You heard that, did you? May I ask the name of your informant?"
"I am sorry, Professor, but the matter was rather confidential. If I have made a mistake, there is no harm done. I can only express my regret."
"Not at all. I should wish to go further into this matter. It interests me. Have you any scrap of writing, any letter or telegram, to bear out your assertion?"
No, I have not."
"I presume that you do not go so far as to assert that I summoned you?"
"I would rather answer no questions," said Holmes.
"No, I dare say not," said the Professor, with asperity. "However, that particular one can be answered very easily without your aid."
He walked across the room to the bell. Our London friend, Mr. Bennet, answered the call.
"Come in, Mr. Bennet. These two gentlemen have come from London under the impression that they have been summoned. You handle all my correspondence. Have you a note of anything going to a person named Holmes?"
"No, sir," Bennet answered with a flush.
"That is conclusive," said the Professor, glaring angrily at my companion. "Now, sir,"
he leaned forward with his two hands upon the table,
"it seems to me that your position is a very questionable one."
Holmes shrugged his shoulders. "I can only repeat that I am sorry that we have made a needless intrusion."
"Hardly enough, Mr. Holmes,"
the old man cried in a high, screaming voice, with extraordinary malignancy upon his face. He got between us and the door as he spoke, and he shook his two hands at us with furious passion.
"You can hardly get out of it so easily as that."
His face was convulsed, and he grinned and gibbered at us in his senseless rage. I am convinced that we should have had to fight our way out of the room if Mr. Bennet had not intervened.
"My dear Professor," he cried, "consider your position. Consider the scandal at the university. Mr. Holmes is a well-known man. You cannot possibly treat him with such discourtesy."
Sulkily, our host, if I may call him so, cleared the path to the door. We were glad to find ourselves outside the house and in the quiet of the tree-lined drive. Holmes seemed greatly amused by the episode. "Our learned friend's nerves are somewhat out of order," said he. "Perhaps our intrusion was a little crude, and yet we have gained that personal contact which I desired. But, dear me, Watson, he is surely at our heels. The villain still pursues us." There were sounds of running feet behind, but it was, to my relief, not the formidable Professor, but his assistant who appeared round the curve of the drive. He came panting up to us.
"I am so sorry, Mr. Holmes. I wished to apologize."
"My dear sir, there is no need. It is all in the way of professional experience.
I have never seen him in a more dangerous mood. But he grows more sinister. You can understand now why his daughter and I are alarmed. And yet his mind is perfectly clear."
"Too clear," said Holmes. "That was my miscalculation. It is evident that his memory is much more reliable than I had thought. By the way, can we, before we go, see the window of Miss Presbury's room?" Mr. Bennet pushed his way through some shrubs, and we had a view of the side of the house.
"It is there, the second on the left."
"Dear me, it seems hardly accessible. And yet you will observe that there is a creeper below and a water pipe above, which give some foothold."
"I could not climb it myself," said Mr. Bennet.
"Very likely. It would certainly be a dangerous exploit for any normal man."
"There was one other thing I wish to tell you, Mr. Holmes. I have the address of the man in London to whom the Professor writes. He seems to have written this morning, and I got it from his blotting paper. It is an ignoble position for a trusted secretary, but what else can I do?"
Holmes glanced at the paper and put it into his pocket. "Dorak, a curious name. Slavonic, I imagine. Well, it is an important link in the chain. We return to London this afternoon, Mr. Bennet. I see no good purpose to be served by our remaining. We cannot arrest the Professor because he has done no crime, nor can we place him under constraint, for he cannot be proved to be mad.
No action is as yet possible.
Then what on earth are we to do?
A little patience, Mr. Bennet. Things will soon develop. Unless I am mistaken, next Tuesday may mark a crisis. Certainly we shall be in Camford on that day. Meanwhile, the general position is undeniably unpleasant, and if Miss Presbrey can prolong her visit, that is easy. Then let her stay till we can assure her that all danger is past. Meanwhile, let him have his way, and do not cross him. So long as he is in a good humour, all is well.
There he is, said Bennet in a startled whisper. Looking between the branches, we saw the tall, erect figure emerge from the hall door and look around him. He stood leaning forward, his hands swinging straight before him, his head turning from side to side. The secretary, with a last wave, slipped off among the trees, and we saw him presently rejoin his employer, the two entering the house together in what seemed to be animated and even excited conversation.
"I expect the old gentleman has been putting two and two together," said Holmes, as we walked hotelward. "He struck me as having a particularly clear and logical brain, from the little I saw of him. Explosive, no doubt, but then from his point of view he has something to explode about if detectives are put on his track and he suspects his own household of doing it. I rather fancy that friend Bennet is in for an uncomfortable time."
Holmes stopped at a post office and sent off a telegram on our way. The answer reached us in the evening, and he tossed it across to me. Have visited the Commercial Road and seen Dorak. Suave person, bohemian, elderly. Keeps large general store, Mercer.
Mercer is since your time, said Holmes. He is my general utility man who looks up routine business. It was important to know something of the man with whom our professor was so secretly corresponding. His nationality connects up with the Prague visit.
Thank goodness that something connects with something, said I. At present we seem to be faced by a long series of inexplicable incidents with no bearing upon each other. For example, what possible connection can there be between an angry wolfhound and a visit to Bohemia, or either of them, with a man crawling down a passage at night? As to your dates, that is the biggest mystification of all. Holmes smiled and rubbed his hands. We were, I may say, seated in the old sitting-room of the ancient hotel, with a bottle of the famous vintage of which Holmes had spoken on the table between us.
Well, now, let us take the dates first, said he, his fingertips together and his manner as if he were addressing a class. This excellent young man's diary shows that there was trouble upon July the 2nd, and from then onward it seems to have been at nine-day intervals, with, so far as I can remember, only one exception. Thus the last outbreak upon Friday was on September the 3rd, which also falls into the series, as did August the 26th, which preceded it. The thing is beyond coincidence.
I was forced to agree.
Let us then form the provisional theory that every 9 days the professor takes some strong drug, which has a passing but highly poisonous effect. His naturally violent nature is intensified by it. He learned to take this drug while he was in Prague, and is now supplied with it by a Bohemian intermediary in London. This all hangs together, Watson.
But the dog, the face of the window, the creeping man in the passage—
Well, we have made a beginning. I should not expect any fresh developments until next Tuesday. In the meantime, we can only keep in touch with friend Bennet and enjoy the amenities of this charming town.
In the morning, Mr. Bennet slipped round to bring us the latest report. As Holmes had imagined, times had not been easy with him. Without exactly accusing him of being responsible for our presence, the professor had been very rough and rude in his speech, and evidently felt some strong grievance. This morning he was quite himself again, however, and had delivered his usual brilliant lecture to a crowded class.
"Apart from his queer fits," said Bennet, "he has actually more energy and vitality than I can ever remember. nor was his brain ever clearer. But it's not he. It's never the man whom we have known.
I don't think you have anything to fear now, for a week at least, Holmes answered. I'm a busy man, and Dr. Watson has his patients to attend to. Let us agree that we meet here at this hour next Tuesday, and I shall be surprised if, before we leave you again, we are not able to explain, even if we cannot perhaps put an end to, your troubles. Meanwhile, keep us posted in what occurs.
I saw nothing of my friend for the next few days, but on the following Monday evening I had a short note asking me to meet him next day at the train. From what he told me as we travelled up to Camford, all was well. The peace of the professor's house had been unruffled, and his own conduct perfectly normal. This was also the report which was given us by Mr. Bennet himself when he called upon us that evening at our old quarters in the Chequers.
He heard from his London correspondent today. There was a letter and there was a small packet, each with the cross under the stamp, which warned me not to touch them. There has been nothing else.
That may prove quite enough, said Holmes grimly. Now, Mr. Bennet, we shall, I think, come to some conclusion tonight. If my deductions are correct, we should have an opportunity of bringing matters to a head. In order to do so, it is necessary to hold the professor under observation. I would suggest, therefore, that you remain awake and on the lookout. Should you hear him pass your door, do not interrupt him, but follow him as discreetly as you can. Dr. Watson and I will not be far off. By the way, where is the key of that little box of which you spoke?
Upon his watch chain.
I fancy our researches must lie in that direction. At the worst, the lock should not be very formidable. Have you any other able-bodied man on the premises?
There is the coachman, MacPhail.
Where does he sleep?
Over the stables.
We might possibly want him. Well, we can do no more until we see how things develop. Goodbye, but I expect that we shall see you before morning.
It was nearly midnight before we took our station among some bushes immediately opposite the hall door of the professor. It was a fine night, but chilly, and we were glad of our warm overcoats. There was a breeze, and clouds were scudding across the sky, obscuring from time to time the half-moon. It would have been a dismal vigil, were it not for the expectation and excitement which carried us along, and the assurance of my comrade that we had probably reached the end of the strange sequence of events which had engaged our attention. If the cycle of 9 days holds good, then we shall have the professor at his worst tonight, said Holmes. The fact that these strange symptoms began after his visit to Prague, that he is in secret correspondence with a Bohemian dealer in London, who presumably represents someone in Prague, and that he received a packet from him this very day, all point in one direction. What he takes, and why he takes it, are still beyond our ken, but that it emanates in some way from Prague is clear enough. He takes it under definite directions which regulate this ninth-day system, which was the first point which attracted my attention. But his symptoms are most remarkable. Did you observe his knuckles? I had to confess that I did not.
Thick and horny in a way which is quite new in my experience. Always look at the hands first, Watson, then cuffs, trouser knees, and boots. Very curious knuckles, which can only be explained by the mode of progression observed by—
Holmes paused and suddenly clapped his hand to his forehead.
Oh, Watson, Watson, what a fool I have been!
It seems incredible, and yet it must be true. All points in one direction. How could I miss seeing the connection of ideas? Those knuckles, how could I have passed those knuckles? And the dog, and the ivy. It's surely time that I disappeared into that little farm of my dreams. Look out, Watson, here he is. We shall have the chance of seeing for ourselves.
The hall door had slowly opened, and against the lamp-lit background we saw the tall figure of Professor Presbrey. He was clad in his dressing-gown.
As he stood outlined in the doorway, he was erect, but leaning forward with dangling arms, as when we saw him last. Now he stepped forward into the drive, and an extraordinary change came over him. He sank down into a crouching position and moved along upon his hands and feet, skipping every now and then as if he were overflowing with energy and vitality. He moved along the face of the house and then round the corner. As he disappeared, Bennett slipped through the hall door and softly followed him.
"Come, Watson, come!" cried Holmes.
And we stole as softly as we could through the bushes until we had gained a spot whence we could see the other side of the house, which was bathed in the light of the half-moon. The Professor was clearly visible, crouching at the foot of the ivy-covered wall. As we watched him, he suddenly began, with incredible agility, to ascend it. From branch to branch he sprang, sure of foot and firm of grasp, climbing, apparently in mere joy at his own powers, with no definite object in view. With his dressing-gown flapping on each side of him, he looked like some huge bat glued against the side of his own house, a great square dark patch upon the moonlit wall. Presently he tired of this amusement, and dropping from branch to branch, he squatted down into the old attitude and moved towards the stables, creeping along in the same strange way as before. The wolfhound was out now, barking furiously and more excited than ever when it actually caught sight of its master. It was straining on its chain and quivering with eagerness and rage. The Professor squatted down very deliberately just out of reach of the hound and began to provoke it in every possible way. He took handfuls of pebbles from the drive and threw them in the dog's face, prodded him with a stick which he had picked up, flicked his hands about only a few inches from the gaping mouth, and endeavoured in every way to increase the animal's fury, which was already beyond all control. In all our adventures, I do not know that I have ever seen a more strange sight than this impassive and still dignified figure, crouching frog-like upon the ground and goading to a wilder exhibition of passion the maddened hound, which ramped and raged in front of him by all manner of ingenious and calculated cruelty. And then, in a moment, it happened. It was not the chain that broke, but it was the collar that slipped, for it had been made for a thick-necked Newfoundland. We heard the rattle of falling metal, and the next instant dog and man were rolling on the ground together, the one roaring in rage, the other screaming in a strange, shrill falsetto of terror. It was a very narrow thing for the Professor's life. The savage creature had him fairly by the throat. Its fangs had bitten deep, and he was senseless before we could reach them and drag the two apart. It might have been a dangerous task for us, but Bennett's voice and presence brought the great wolfhound instantly to reason. The uproar had brought the sleepy and astonished coachman from his room above the stables. "I'm not surprised," said he, shaking his head. "I've seen him at it before, and knew the dog would get him sooner or later." The hound was secured, and together we carried the Professor up to his room, where Bennett, who had a medical degree, helped me to dress his torn throat. The sharp teeth had passed dangerously near the carotid artery, and the hemorrhage was serious. In half an hour the danger was past. I had given the patient an injection of morphia, and he had sunk into deep sleep. Then, and only then, were we able to look at each other and to take stock of the situation.
"I think a first-class surgeon should see him," said I.
"For God's sake, no!" cried Bennett. "At present the scandal is confined to our own household. It is safe with us. If it gets beyond these walls, it will never stop. Consider his position at the university, his European reputation, the feelings of his daughter."
"Quite so," said Holmes.
I think it may be quite possible to keep the matter to ourselves, and also to prevent its recurrence now that we have a free hand. The key from the watch-chain, Mr. Bennet. MacPhail will guard the patient and let us know if there is any change. Let us see what we can find in the professor's mysterious box.
There was not much, but there was enough. An empty file, another nearly full, a hypodermic syringe, several letters in a crabbed foreign hand. The marks on the envelopes showed that they were those which had disturbed the routine of the secretary, and each was dated from the Commercial Road and signed A. Dorak. They were mere invoices to say that a fresh bottle was being sent to Professor Presbury, or receipt to acknowledge money. There was one other envelope, however, in a more educated hand and bearing the Austrian stamp with the postmark of Prague. "Here we have our material," cried Holmes, as he tore out the enclosure. "Honoured colleague," it ran, "since your esteemed visit, I have thought much of your case, and though in your circumstances there are some special reasons for the treatment, I would nonetheless enjoin caution, as my results have shown that it is not without danger of a kind. It is possible that the serum of anthropoid would have been better. I have, as I explained to you, used black-faced languor because a specimen was accessible. Languor is, of course, a crawler and climber, while anthropoid walks erect and is in always nearer. I beg you to take every possible precaution that there be no premature revelation of the process. I have one other client in England, and Dorak is my agent for both. Weekly reports will oblige. Yours with high esteem, H. Lowenstein." Lowenstein! The name brought back to me the memory of some snippet from a newspaper which spoke of an obscure scientist who was striving in some unknown way for the secret of rejuvenescence and the elixir of life. Lowenstein of Prague. Lowenstein with the wondrous strength-giving serum, tabooed by the profession because he refused to reveal its source. In a few words I said what I remembered. Bennet had taken a manual of zoology from the shelves. "Langa," he read, "the great black-faced monkey of the Himalayan slopes, biggest and most human of climbing monkeys." Many details are added. "Well, thanks to you, Mr. Holmes, it is very clear that we have traced the evil to its source."
"The real source," said Holmes, "lies, of course, in that untimely love affair, which gave our impetuous professor the idea that he could only gain his wish by turning himself into a younger man. When one tries to rise above nature, one is liable to fall below it. The highest type of man may revert to the animal if he leaves the straight road of destiny." He sat, musing for a little, with the phial in his hand, looking at the clear liquid within. "When I have written to this man and told him that I hold him criminally responsible for the poisons which he circulates, we will have no more trouble. But it may recur. Others may find a better way. There is danger there, a very real danger to humanity. Consider, Watson, that the material, the sensual, the worldly, would all prolong their worthless lives. The spiritual would not avoid the call to something higher. It would become the survival of the least fit. What sort of cesspool may not our poor world become?" Suddenly, the dreamer disappeared, and Holmes, the man of action, sprang from his chair. "I think there is nothing more to be said, Mr. Bennet. The various incidents will now fit themselves easily into the general scheme. The dog, of course, was aware of the change far more quickly than you. His smell would ensure that. It was the monkey, not the professor, whom Roy attacked, just as it was the monkey who teased Roy. Climbing was a joy to the creature, and it was a mere chance, I take it, that the pastime brought him to the young lady's window.
"There is an early train to town, Watson, but I think we shall just have time for a cup of tea at the Chequers before we catch it."
The Adventure of the Sussex Vampire. Holmes had read carefully a note which the last post had brought him. Then, with the dry chuckle which was his nearest approach to a laugh, he tossed it over to me. "For a mixture of the modern and the medieval, of the practical and of the wildly fanciful, I think this is surely the limit," said he. "What do you make of it, Watson?" I read as follows. 46, Old Jewry, November the 19th, Ray, Vampires. "Sir, our client, Mr. Robert Ferguson, of Ferguson and Muirhead, tea brokers, of Mincing Lane, has made some inquiry from us in a communication of even date concerning vampires. As our firm specializes entirely upon the assessment of machinery, the matter hardly comes within our purview, and we have therefore recommended Mr. Ferguson to call upon you and lay the matter before you. We have not forgotten your successful action in the case of Matilda Briggs. We are, sir, faithfully yours, Morrison, Morrison and Dodd, per EJC. "Matilda Briggs was not the name of a young woman, Watson," said Holmes in a reminiscent voice. "It was a ship which is associated with the giant rat of Sumatra, a story for which the world is not yet prepared. But what do we know about vampires? Does it come within our purview either? Anything is better than stagnation. But really, we seem to have been switched on to a Grimm's fairy tale. Make a long arm, Watson, and see what V has to say." I leaned back and took down the great index volume to which he referred. Holmes balanced it on his knee, and his eyes moved slowly and lovingly over the record of old cases mixed with the accumulated information of a lifetime. "Voyage of the Glorious Scot," he read. "That was a bad business. I have some recollection that you made a record of it, Watson, though I was unable to congratulate you upon the result. Victor Lynch, the forger. Venomous Lizard or Gila. Remarkable case, that. Victoria, the Circus Bell. Vanderbilt and the Yeggman. Vipers. Vigor, the Hammersmith Wonder. Oh, hello, hello. Good old index. You can't beat it. Listen to this, Watson. Vampirism in Hungary. And again, vampires in Transylvania." He turned over the pages with eagerness, but after a short, intent perusal, he threw down the great book with a snarl of disappointment. "Rubbish, Watson, rubbish! What have we to do with walking corpses who can only be held in their grave by stakes driven through their hearts? It's pure lunacy." "Surely," said I, "the vampire was not necessarily a dead man. A living person might have the habit. I have read, for example, of the old sucking the blood of the young in order to retain their youth." "You are right, Watson. It mentions the legend in one of these references. But are we to give serious attention to such things? This agency stands flat-footed upon the ground, and there it must remain. The world is big enough for us. No ghosts need apply. I fear that we cannot take Mr. Robert Ferguson very seriously. Possibly this note may be from him, and may throw some light upon what is worrying him." He took up a second letter, which had lain unnoticed upon the table while he had been absorbed with the first. This he began to read with a smile of amusement upon his face, which gradually faded away into an expression of intense interest and concentration. When he had finished, he sat for some little time lost in thought, with the letter dangling from his fingers. Finally, with a start, he aroused himself from his reverie. "Cheeseman's Lamberley. Where is Lamberley, Watson?"
"It's in Sussex, south of Horsham."
"Not very far, eh? And Cheeseman's?"
"I know that country, Holmes. It is full of old houses which are named after the men who built them centuries ago. You get Audleys and Harveys and Carrotons,
The folk are forgotten, but their names live in their houses.
Precisely, said Holmes, coldly.
It was one of the peculiarities of his proud, self-contained nature that though he docketed any fresh information very quietly and accurately in his brain, he seldom made any acknowledgment to the giver.
I rather fancy we shall know a good deal more about Cheeseman's, Lamberley, before we are through. The letter is, as I had hoped, from Robert Ferguson. By the way, he claims acquaintance with you.
With me?
You'd better read it.
He handed the letter across. It was headed with the address quoted. Dear Mr. Holmes, it said, I've been recommended to you by my lawyers, but indeed the matter is so extraordinarily delicate that it is most difficult to discuss. It concerns a friend for whom I am acting. This gentleman married some 5 years ago a Peruvian lady, the daughter of a Peruvian merchant, whom he had met in connection with the importation of nitrates. The lady was very beautiful, but the fact of her foreign birth and of her alien religion always caused a separation of interests and of feelings between husband and wife, so that after a time his love may have cooled towards her, and he may have come to regard their union as a mistake. He felt there were sides of her character which he could never explore or understand. This was the more painful, as she was as loving a wife as a man could have, to all appearance, absolutely devoted. Now for the point which I will make more plain when we meet. Indeed, this note is merely to give you a general idea of the situation, and to ascertain whether you would care to interest yourself in the matter. The lady began to show some curious traits quite alien to her ordinarily sweet and gentle disposition. The gentleman had been married twice, and he had one son by the first wife. This boy was now 15, a very charming and affectionate youth, though unhappily injured through an accident in childhood. Twice the wife was caught in the act of assaulting this poor lad in the most unprovoked way. Once she struck him with a stick and left a great weal on his arm. This was a small matter, however, compared with her conduct to her own child, a dear boy just under 1 year of age. On one occasion, about a month ago, this child had been left by its nurse for a few minutes. A loud cry from the baby, as of pain, called the nurse back. As she ran into the room, she saw her employer, the lady, leaning over the baby and apparently biting his neck. There was a small wound in the neck from which a stream of blood had escaped. The nurse was so horrified that she wished to call the husband, but the lady implored her not to do so, and actually gave her £5 as a price for her silence. No explanation was ever given, and for the moment the matter was passed over. It left, however, a terrible impression upon the nurse's mind, and from that time she began to watch her mistress closely and to keep a closer guard upon the baby, whom she tenderly loved. It seemed to her that even as she watched the mother, so the mother watched her, and that every time she was compelled to leave the baby alone, the mother was waiting to get at it. Day and night the nurse covered the child, and day and night the silent, watchful mother seemed to be lying in wait, as a wolf waits for a lamb. It must read most incredible to you, and yet I beg you to take it seriously, for a child's life and a man's sanity may depend upon it. At last there came one dreadful day when the facts could no longer be concealed from the husband. The nurse's nerve had given way. She could stand the strain no longer, and she made a clean breast of it all to the man. To him it seemed as wild a tale as it may now seem to you. He knew his wife to be a loving wife, and save for the assaults upon her stepson, a loving mother. Why, then, should she wound her own dear little baby? He told the nurse that she was dreaming, that her suspicions were those of a lunatic, and that such libels upon her mistress were not to be tolerated. While they were talking, a sudden cry of pain was heard. Nurse and master rushed together to the nursery. Imagine his feelings, Mr. Holmes, as he saw his wife rise from a kneeling position beside the cot and saw blood upon the child's exposed neck and upon the sheet.
With a cry of horror, he turned his wife's face to the light and saw blood all round her lips. It was she, beyond all question, who had drunk the poor baby's blood. So the matter stands. She is now confined to her room. There's been no explanation. The husband is half demented. He knows, and I know, little of vampirism beyond the name. We had thought it was some wild tale of foreign parts, and yet here in the very heart of the English Sussex. Well, all this can be discussed with you in the morning. Will you see me? Will you use your great powers in aiding a distracted man? If so, kindly wire to Ferguson, Cheesemans, Lamberley, and I will be at your rooms by 10 o'clock. Yours faithfully, Robert Ferguson. P.S. I believe your friend Watson played rugby for Blackheath when I was three-quarter for Richmond. It is the only personal introduction which I can give. Of course I remembered him, said I, as I laid down the letter. Big Bob Ferguson, the finest three-quarter Richmond ever had. He was always a good-natured chap. It's like him to be so concerned over a friend's case. Holmes looked at me thoughtfully and shook his head. "I never get your limits, Watson," said he. "There are unexplored possibilities about you. Take a wire down, like a good fellow. We'll examine your case with pleasure."
"Your case?"
"We must not let him think that this agency is a home for the weak-minded. Of course it is his case. Send him that wire, and let the matter rest till morning." Promptly at 10 o'clock next morning, Ferguson strode into our room. I had remembered him as a long, slab-sided man, with loose limbs and a fine turn of speed, which had carried him round many an opposing back. There is surely nothing in life more painful than to meet the wreck of a fine athlete whom one has known in his prime. His great frame had fallen in, his flaxen hair was scanty, and his shoulders were bowed. I fear that I roused corresponding emotions in him. "Hello, Watson," said he, and his voice was still deep and hearty. "You don't look quite the man you did when I threw you over the ropes into the crowd at the old Deer Park. I expect I have changed a bit also. But it's this last day or two that has aged me. I see by your telegram, Mr. Holmes, that it is no use my pretending to be anybody's deputy."
"It is simpler to deal direct," said Holmes.
"Of course it is. But you can imagine how difficult it is when you are speaking of the one woman whom you are bound to protect and help. What can I do? How am I to go to the police with such a story? And yet the kiddies have got to be protected. Is it madness, Mr. Holmes? Is it something in the blood? Have you any similar case in your experience? For God's sake, give me some advice, for I am at my wit's end."
"Very naturally, Mr. Ferguson. Now sit here and pull yourself together and give me a few clear answers. I can assure you that I am very far from being at my wit's end, and that I am confident we shall find some solution. First of all, tell me what steps you have taken. Is your wife still near the children? We had a dreadful scene. She is a most loving woman, Mr. Holmes. If ever a woman loved a man with all her heart and soul, she loves me. She was cut to the heart that I should have discovered this horrible, this incredible secret. She would not even speak. She gave no answer to my reproaches save to gaze at me with a sort of